Hi, everyone. It's Jody. Welcome to another episode of Mummy Brain Revisited. Today, I'm going to be talking with Dr. Pascal Vrtichka, who is an associate professor and senior lecturer in psychology at the University of Essex. And we're going to be talking about all things neurosynchrony and attachment between parents and children.
Soundstripe.
It is a pleasure to have you here, Pascal, and I'm really excited to talk with you about your research. And a little bit, I think we'll talk about attachment because that's an attachment theory, because that's what you're an expert in. And I'm going to put all the information so people can contact you on social media and ask you questions, because Pascal has a Q&A opportunity for everyone who needs to know about attachment. And I think we all need to know a little bit more about the science of attachment. But today we're going to talk a little bit more about your parental brain research, which of course I'm guessing is important for your research on attachment theory, but you'll tell us about this. But my first question really is, and this is when I ask everyone, is how did you get interested in the neuroscience of parenting or the parental brain?
Yeah, first of all, thanks a lot for having me. It's a big pleasure. So how did I become interested in the parental brain? My interest in the parental brain has been steadily growing over the last year. So when I started my PhD in social neuroscience, I mainly focused on the neurobiological basis of attachment in adults without children. So okay. I invited participants to the lab, had them fill in self-reports mainly about romantic attachment, and then I scanned their brains with functional magnetic resonance imaging while I showed them images or short movies of social situations. But then after a while, I also wanted to look at the neural basis of attachment towards parents. So I started to invite younger participants, adolescents, and children to the lab. And from there, it was just the next logical step to also look at the opposite of attachment, so to speak, or the complementary system to attachment, which is caregiving and parenting. And to do so, I'm nowadays not only looking at brain structure and activity in parents, both moms and dads, but also brain-to-brain synchrony between parents and their children during direct social interaction using functional near-infrared spectroscopy hyperscanning. This allows me to investigate the neurobiology of parenting and attachment simultaneously across generations, which I think holds the best promise to better understand the very complex relationship between attachment and caregiving on a neurobiological level.
Wow. Okay. So then this also is making me think you could also look at, so you looked at romantic partners, you've looked at kids and their brains, you've looked at parents and parents and kids, and we're going to talk about a study shortly. But then you could look at romantic, like the parents' relationship and the kids. You could even make it a triad type neurosynchrony research area. Anyway.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm already jumping into your future. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But this is really interesting. And then, so, and if I heard you correctly, you said you were looking at the children because of the attachment piece and looking at their brains, correct?
Yes. Yeah, so, after having looked at adults and adolescents, we then invited children. They were 8 to 12 years old. And we showed them some pictures. I think in one study, we used pictures of their mothers and we morphed them into pictures of age-matched females that they didn't know. And we looked at how they perceive these different degrees of knowing somebody and not knowing somebody as a function of their self-reported attachment. So that's one of the studies okay. We did only in children.
And then I guess on the flip side, I mean, parents can be attached to their kids too in different ways, right?
Yeah. So here I think we should just be a little bit careful about the language. So we should probably not say that parents are attached to the children, but there is the parents are bonded to the children. Because if we talk about it from an attachment theory perspective, the attachment is always directed towards a attachment figure that provides support and soothe this when we are in distress. And this function should at least initially not be the children's function, that should be the parents' function. So, when we talk about attachment, it's always the direction of the child towards the parent. And if we talk about the flip side, we should be using caregiving or parenting or bonding, so that we are not confusing these constructs.
Oh, that's interesting, because that's actually great to clarify that, because you want to be attached to someone who provide you protection, security, and care, essentially. So parents, although some do attach to their kids, unfortunately, this is not the role of the child, right? So,
that's when we then usually speak about the role reversal, which can have negative influence on the attachment of the child towards the parent, especially in very young age. So we would usually not really encourage that to happen.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm already learning so much, basically, about attachment. This is why I don't talk about attachment, because it's too complicated. Not complicated, actually. I think it's been misused, the terminology. You and I have discussed this in the past. Like, there's a misuse of use of the terminology, and it's attachment theory, and the science of it is quite a bit different than actually what we talk about in social media or in the news often, unfortunately. And I think that, maybe tell us a bit of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I think there is just a little bit of, or not a little bit, there's quite some confusion, and we get lost in translation these days when we talk about attachment. But that's also partially attachment theory's fault, because it is not always consistent. There are different traditions within attachment theory and research. For example, the developmental psychology tradition and the social psychology tradition. And they are sometimes referring to the same concepts, but not using the same terminology. So there is already some confusion coming from the field itself. But then many things were picked up by people outside academia from social media. And that has caused even more confusion. So what I'm trying to do these days, and what we are actually trying to do within the Society for Emotion and Attachment Studies, is to try to clarify this terminology, to provide scientifically exact definitions, but at the same time, definitions that are accessible and easy to understand. And this has just started, and I wrote about it also on The Conversation. I had an interview in Vice recently about that. And it's really something I also would like to push with my attachment Q&A now, to promote the attachment science, because there is lots of attachment science, and we just need to make sure that it reaches everybody in its pure form and scientific form, and that it's not confused too much, and that we all know what we are talking about when we speak about attachment.
And I think this is great. I mean, it's great that you have the Q&A and you're putting the information out there. I think it's hard to, change people's perspectives often with science, unfortunately, but at least you are starting somewhere. So I think, I think this is great. And I will leave the attachment theory science up to you completely.
Thank you. We'll see where this leads, but I'm optimistic.
Yeah, I am too. I'm actually happy that you're doing this, because I see this, attachment parenting stuff comes up for me a lot. And I'm just like, I don't think that's really attachment theory science. Or people use attachment like, but I don't want my child to be insecurely attached. And then, or they'll be, basically not developed properly. And I'm always like, a lot of stuff can change, but I don't know the science, and where you know the science. And so this is really nice to have you accessible for the general public. Yeah. And I know, you have some nice questions. So hop onto your Pascal's Instagram and check out some of the Q&As and send them some questions. But let's go back to the brain science, the parental brain science. And I know you have a lot of really interesting studies you're doing. But I thought I'd pick one recent one on dads, father and child neurosynchrony. So you can tell us maybe what that is in a second, but also neurosynchrony when they're problem solving. And I thought this was really interesting area of investigation. I mean, I love the neurosynchrony field, because I think it's super cool to be able to look at how our brains are functioning together when we're doing something, but specifically with parenting. So maybe you can tell us a bit about the study.
Yes, of course. I'd love to. So in that study, we invited dads with their 5 to 6 year old preschool children to the lab. And we put caps on and optotes on to use functional near-infrared spectroscopy hyperscanning.
And maybe just, I'm going to pause you there. So that's, sometimes we call that FNIRS.
Yes.
And maybe you can tell us just briefly, it looks at what in the brain? What is it telling us, essentially?
Yeah, so basically FNIRS uses infrared light that can reach the outermost layers of the brain. And we can then indirectly detect how much activity there was in a certain brain area at a specific time. So it's not like EEG, it's not measuring electrical activity, but it is looking at blood flow and blood oxygenation. But it is quite advantageous with infants and children because it is not very susceptible to movement. So the children can actually quite freely move. They don't have to be very still. And we can use more of the data. For example, EEG is quite more difficult with children.
Okay. So this is, it's an easier way to look at how the brain is changing, but essentially the outer layers, let's say, of the brain, and they can move. So when they can do a task together and stuff like this, so they're not, don't have to stand still like in a fMRI.
Exactly. So that's the advantage. Yeah. So the disadvantage, of course, is that we can only look at the outermost layer of the brain. So we cannot go deeper to, for example, measure amygdala or insula or these kinds of regions. But still, there are many cortical areas that are important and interesting to look at, especially for social interaction.
Yeah. Okay. So you had dads and their kids come into the lab, put the caps on, and then?
Yes. So then we had them do some problem solving together, and more specifically, some puzzling. And what we used were 10 grams. So basically, the dads and the kids, they got a template, and then they had 7 wooden blocks, and they had to recreate those templates. And we had 2 conditions. The first condition was a cooperation condition, where there was 1 puzzle for both dads and children, and they had to help each other to reproduce the template. And then we had another condition, which was our control condition, the independent condition, where we put a removable barrier between the dads and the kids. And each of them got 1 puzzle, and they had to puzzle individually. They had to solve the puzzle on their own.
Oh, interesting.
And,
okay.
Besides recording the brain activity with FNIRS, we also filmed the interaction, and we then coded the behavior with attachment theory-related scales for interaction quality. And we also had measures of attachment in both children and dads. So the children, they did a story stem completion procedure. So they were told beginnings of stories, and then they had to tell us and show us with Lego Duplo figures what will happen next. And these stories were always attachment related. And in the fathers, we had self-reports about their caregiving beliefs. And we also had the adult attachment interview in fathers to assess the dad's attachment in general.
Okay. And this would be attachment to their partner, their parent, or?
So on dads, the adult attachment interview is a more general measure of attachment, but it quite often refers to their own relationships with their parents. They think about their past. Have also about some experiences of loss, and the coherence of these interviews then helps us to code their attachment in terms of security or anxiety or avoidance.
Okay. And so then, and I maybe should have asked this first, but what was your aim? Like, why did you think of doing this study?
So first of all, we wanted to see whether there is a difference in brain-to-brain synchrony between dads and their kids as compared to moms and their kids. Because before that study involving dads, we did almost the same study in moms and their children. So we actually wanted to see whether there is any brain-to-brain synchrony in dads and their children at all, because nobody has really looked at this systematically before we did that. And secondly, we wanted to see how the brain-to-brain synchrony in parent-child dyads relates to interaction behavior and relationship quality from an attachment and caregiving perspective. Again, in fathers themselves, because that hasn't really been done so far, but then also compared to mothers, which we had just done before and published before that.
Okay. So yeah, this is interesting that I like this attachment piece, right? That obviously I'm not surprised you brought in, but also relating it to brain changes and brain synchrony. So you're getting really like a more complete story, I think, than what we've been doing in the past, definitely around this topic. So then what's my next question here? I'm like, I have to keep focused because I have lots of questions. So maybe you can tell us then, like, basically what were your main findings?
So the main findings were that dads and kids do synchronize their brain activity when they problem solve, and that the overall pattern of the synchrony is very similar to the pattern that we see in moms when they interact with their children.
Okay. And what, I mean, maybe tell us what brain areas are involved then.
Yes. So with FDR's hyperscanning, the thing is that we can usually not really look at the whole brain. So we have to pick some areas that we think are most relevant and most important for social interaction. So what we looked at is the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is a very important region for attention, for regulation. So for more the cognitive aspect of the interaction. And then we looked at the temporoparietal junction, the TPJ, which is a region that is thought to be involved in theory of mind, in mentalizing, in thinking of what the other person is thinking and in predicting what the other person is going to do next. Mm-hmm. Also in relation to what we want to predict, what we will be doing next. And I think this mutual prediction is at the core of the theory around brain-to-brain synchrony. So we think, and others in the field think as well, that there should be more brain-to-brain synchrony during social interaction if we are better able to predict not only what we will be doing next, but what the interaction partner is going to do next.
Okay. So then in the dads, as well as in your previous research in moms, you saw that both these areas were increased in activity in the brain.
Yes. So not in activity, but in synchrony. Yes.
In synchrony. So then tell me, okay, because this is a piece, and I know I've talked to like Vicky Leung about the synchrony,
yes.
And what I understood from her, which was great, is that it's more of a dance. It's not, because for me, I'm thinking synchrony as a mirroring of like my brain does this, your brain does that, but this is actually not it. It means that it's coordinated in a positive way, I guess. So then in the kids' brains, what happens or what does this mean? Maybe explain the synchrony bit.
Yes. So that's a little bit complicated because from the general understanding is synchrony is something that happens when exactly the same thing happens at exactly the same time.
Yeah.
But that's not, I mean, you can derive such a measure from FNIRS data, but we usually don't. So what we derive from FNIRS data is whether the brain activity in this case, dads and children, was somehow correlated in time. And this correlation doesn't have to be if dad's activity goes up, the child's activity has to go up at the very same time. There can be a lag. So dad's activity goes up first and child's activity goes up afterwards. Or there can be a lag in the opposite direction. Child activity goes up first and the dad's activity follows. What can also happen is that the activity is opposite. So when the dad has most activity, the child has the least activity or vice versa. And what this basically means is that, and I think that's what you just said, we can think of this as a dance, in that one brain activity follows the other in a predictable way, in a consistent way, but the people or the brain activities don't have to do exactly the same thing at the same time.
Okay, yeah. So that's important point, is that it's not a mirroring. But this also is making me think it's, of course, like interactions and behaviors with each other, right? We're not mirroring each other when we're interacting, when we're synchronous and working together. We're coordinated, essentially.
Yeah, so mirroring is one part of it.
Yeah.
So we know that synchrony increases in two brains when people are just seeing the same thing at the same time or hearing the same thing. But what we really want to get at is more this mutual prediction account. So that the synchrony really represents something that is newly co-created as a result of the interaction. It's not just something that automatically happens, but it's something that really emerges just through this interaction when two people do something at the same time.
Okay.
The issue is that we cannot attribute causality. So we cannot say that there needs to be more synchrony for the social interaction to work, because we can only look at correlations. But of course, we assume that the behavior and the brain activity is somehow related to one another. That,
right.
That by better predicting on a neural basis, that then this influences the interaction, that there is a better interaction quality, that there is a better interaction outcome, even though we cannot attribute a causal relationship, technically speaking.
Right. So it's all an association or correlation. But then it's making me think, okay, so were the parent and child pairs, the dad and child pairs that were better at problem solving together, more synchronous?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So first of all, what we saw in mouse and children and in dads and children is that the synchrony was higher during the cooperation than during the independent task.
Okay.
So when the parents were doing the puzzles together with the kids, there was more synchrony, which I would say makes sense, because there has to be more prediction and more interaction happening in at roughly the same time. The very interesting thing is that the correlation between the neural synchrony and the behavior was different when we looked at moms versus dads. So in the mothers, there was more, in the mother-child dyads, there was more synchrony during puzzling together when the interaction was more harmonious, when there was more turn-taking, when once the mom took the lead, once the child took the lead, and there was, there was a change between these turn-taking leading figures, so to speak. What we also found in the mom-child dyads is that the synchrony was higher the more puzzles they solved together. So there was a link to the task outcome. And finally, what we also found in the mother-child dyads is that when the moms filled in a self-report questionnaire about stress, how stressed they are in general, but how stressed they are also more specifically in their role as mothers. And what we saw is that the more the moms were stressed, or the more the moms indicated to be stressed, the lower was the synchrony during this problem solving. So these were quite interesting findings in mothers. But what was even more interesting was the fact that none of these relationships were present when we looked at the dads when they interacted with their children. So we didn't find any correlation between the behavior and the brain in the father-child dyads. However, what we did find in the father-child dyads is that the brain-to-brain synchrony during cooperative puzzle solving was correlated to the dad's caregiving beliefs. So he had the fathers filled in a questionnaire, and they were asked how important they think it is to be a father, how positive they feel about their parenting role, and how much they enjoy spending time together with their children. And here we found that the higher the father scored on this role of the father questionnaire, the more synchrony there was during the cooperative puzzle solving with their children.
That, I think, is fascinating.
Yes, I agree.
It's really fascinating, because you see, did you ask that question to the mothers in the study, the same questionnaire?
So actually we had three studies. The first, it was in moms and children, then we did the that child study, and then we did another mother-child study, and in that study we also looked at this, but we haven't analyzed the data yet.
Okay, I'm guessing in the moms you're not going to find the same effect, because they probably assume, many of them assume, the importance of their role, whereas what I'm hearing is the dads who felt that their role as a dad, or that their interaction with the child was important, that they had more synchrony during tasks. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah, so they are. I think there are two messages here. The first message is that every interaction is different.
Yep.
And there seem to be differences between the way moms and dads interact with their children. And this is not only something we have found in our study. This has already been found many times before, simply by looking at interaction behavior. And there are different theories about this. But generally speaking, I think this is actually quite good, because the more different interaction partners the children have, the more different social emotional skills they can learn, right? And this will very likely extend beyond the parents. So there will be different patterns with grandparents, with siblings, with friends, peers, romantic partners, teachers. And all of these differences are interesting and meaningful, because, as I said, they might give us some insight into the different qualities of these interactions and the different learning experiences. The second message is that, especially for fathers, it seems that the amount of their neurobiological changes when men become fathers seems to more strongly depend on their the amount of time they spent with their children and the quality of the time they spent with their children. So for dads, this practice kind of aspect, or this involvement aspect linked to their caregiving relief, seems to be a bit stronger than for moms. But generally speaking, I think the sentence that parents are not born but made sums this really nicely up. And this it holds true for any kind of parent, including both mothers and fathers.
Yeah, 100% agree with that, because I think it's all about experience and interaction. But I do find it fascinating that a dad's belief about caregiving is predictive of how his brain is responding, right? Like, this is interesting.
Yeah, I just want to, again, we have to be slightly careful with language here. So I wouldn't use the word predictive, because it was just a correlation, right? So I would say that there is an association between father's caregiving beliefs and the synchrony. We don't know which one causes the other. But what makes us a bit more confident about this finding is that we, in the same fathers, or in, so this study here that used FNIRS, we had 66 fathers, but 50 of these fathers, we could then also scan with fMRI or with MRI, with magnetic resonance imaging, and we could look at their brain structure. And so far, we have only looked at their hypothalamus volume, because the other brain areas are still being analyzed. But the hypothalamus is very important for many different processes, for sleep, for eating, for sexual activity, but also for caregiving, because it's the main region where oxytocin, for example, is synthesized. But it's also strongly related to stress, because also the stress axis with cortisol is being mediated by the hypothalamus. And what we did there is we looked at the hypothalamus volume in our 55 dads from the FNIR study, and in 45 men who were almost the same age but don't have any children. And what we found is that there was no difference in the hypothalamus volume between fathers and non-fathers as such. But very interestingly, again, in the fathers, the hypothalamus volume was again related to their caregiving beliefs. So the stronger were the dads' caregiving beliefs, the larger was their hypothalamus. So again, we have a correlation here, but we have a correlation between the same caregiving construct, the same caregiving beliefs, and not only brain-to-brain synchrony between dads and their children, but also between brain structure and dads by themselves. And so we think we are really getting somewhere here, because we have two independent, well, partially independent sets of data that show that caregiving beliefs are important for dads on two levels, deep within their brain in regards to their hypothalamus volume, but then also at the surface of their brain in terms of the synchrony when they interact with their children.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. And these are, I also want to say that these are positive caregiving beliefs. Like they believe that their role is important.
Yes.
And so this is related with these brain changes. And as you pointed out, are the brain changes existing before the beliefs? Like we don't know exactly the relationship between the two, the sets of data, let's say, but there's something there with beliefs. But then I also want to point out, you have not investigated this in moms yet.
Yes.
The same idea.
Not yet.
It's in the works.
Yes. So we also have structural brain scans in moms. And for both moms and dads, we don't only have the hypothalamus volume, but we have actually the whole brain. We have cortical areas, we have subcortical areas, we have many different networks. And we are currently looking at these data to compare moms and dads and to look at relationships between brain structure and attachment, but also caregiving, and whether we can link this also to the synchrony data in both moms and dads.
Okay, cool. So I would be really interested to see what comes out from moms, right? With about caregiving beliefs.
Yeah, me too. Brain. But we have to be a bit more patient. It's a lot of work, and it takes some time, because we also want to make sure that we do the science properly, right? And not rush it. And
yeah, definitely. Yeah. And before we leave this piece, I also want to ask about the stress levels. And so, I mean, in the moms and the dads, were the stress measurements equivalent? And because you said in the moms, it was more related, you can see this relationship between her stress and the neurosynchrony, and not in the dads. But then I was wondering, are the moms more stressed?
Yeah, basically? That's a very good question. We just have a paper under review right now where we directly compare moms and dads, but only in respect to their behavior and their attachment from the adult attachment interview. I don't think we have directly compared them yet in terms of the stress levels.
I would be curious, about the range of like what you're finding in comparison, right? But okay, so that's still in the works as well. But next question for me is, what about attachment then, attachment styles or the results of the questionnaires and the neurosynchrony in, the child and the dad?
Yes. So that's exactly part of the paper that is under review at the moment.
Okay.
And there we took the brain-to-brain synchrony in both the moms and the children and the dads and the children. And we combined it with these attachment measures in children from the story completion task. And we took the adult attachment interview codings from the parents. And so we wanted to see whether the child attachment is related to the synchrony and whether the parent attachment is related to the synchrony and whether this depends on both the biological sex of the child and the biological sex of the parent.
Yeah. Okay. Cause that was a question I had.
Yes.
Okay. And.
And the short answer is that we did find some differences, which are part of the paper that is under review, but the patterns are a little bit more complicated than we had hoped for, or that we thought, in that there seems to be a relationship between child attachment and the neural synchrony. But that depends on whether the children are boys or girls. And there also seems to be an association between the parent attachment and the neural synchrony. But again, it seems to depend whether the parent is a dad or a mom.
Interesting.
Unfortunately, the sample we have, even though it's the largest sample to date that has both attachment from the kids and the parents, so we are somewhere in the range of 90 or 100 dyads, which is a lot for these attachment measures. And the sample is still too small to look at all the different combinations. You know, boy, father, girl, mother, and both attachments. So we cannot really look at this very complex interaction pattern. But I think it's a very good start to show that we do find associations between attachment in both kids and parents and neural synchrony, but that these patterns are probably quite complicated and we need more research to look at what they exactly mean.
Yeah. And then how, like, I guess, what do they mean and how important are they in development, I guess, would be the other question, or even in terms of this problem-solving task, was the attachment style or, you know, the results of the attachment or the measurements of attachment associated with the ability to problem solve?
Yes, that's a very good point. Of course, there are situations where attachment is more important and others where attachment is not that important. But one thing that we haven't talked about yet is the question of whether more synchrony is actually always better.
Yeah.
Or whether it could be that more synchrony is sometimes actually worse, right? Because most of the research so far is looking at synchrony in terms of, as I said, prediction and positive relationship quality and more secure attachment. But synchrony might also be related to stress, to negative emotions. So if, for example, the parent is really stressed, and then the synchrony might help, or not help, but the synchrony will kind of lead to the child also becoming stressed. And then we have a propagation of negative emotions.
But a synchronous brain.
Yes. Or,
yeah, I see what you're saying.
And so in that context, we need much more research on tasks that are stressful, that are a bit more challenging, that are negative, because our puzzle-solving task, you know, was still pretty playful. We didn't tell the parents that they have to hurry, that they have to solve a certain number of puzzles in a short time. It was just a playful interaction. But what we really need is also more stressful interactions where we can then look at whether higher synchrony leads to more stress, more negative experiences, or maybe even is associated with more insecure attachment. And that's what the latest theory is going towards in saying that there is probably an optimal mid-range of synchrony, and that both too little synchrony but also too much synchrony might actually be detrimental. And that's also something we want to be looking at more in the future.
And this is in terms of brain neural synchrony, but I'm also guessing this is in terms of, we could think of it in terms of behavioral synchrony, where you
absolutely
don't want. Yeah, because especially with child development, I'm thinking adults, it's a bit different adult to adult, but with child development, you want them, you want to push and pull, right? They need to develop independence from you to some degree. I'm guessing, I'm not a child psychologist or developmental psychologist, but there's, yeah, it's different, the relationship definitely between a caregiver and a child versus an adult to an adult.
Yes, so that's something that Shira Otsul is looking at, and she was at the conference that we attended to.
Yeah, and I'll have a podcast with her soon as well.
Yeah, so maybe she can speak much better to this.
Yeah.
But the general idea here is that there needs to be co-regulation, because the parent also in their function as an attachment figure has this role of helping the child co-regulate emotions. And I always make the example of, you know, if you have a child and the child is crying, and then you have a parent come and the parent just also start crying, then that's not going to help anybody. So what really needs to happen there...
Which has happened in my house recently, okay?
Now,
happen, people.
I think it's good initially, because when the parent also cries, there is a lot of empathy going on, right? And empathy helps.
Yeah.
Empathy helps the parent understand what's really going on, how the child is feeling. But then to make the child feel better, we have to switch to this compassion mode, to this co-regulation mode. And then, as Shia is very nicely showing, then usually the mom goes into the opposite. And so into a very positive state, a very encouraging state, a very quiet, calm state. And that then helps the child to regulate most. And it would be really fascinating to see, and I would actually expect that during those co-regulation moments, the synchrony will become different, or there might even be a short desynchronization, and then eventually a resynchronization. And the patterns of this synchrony lack of synchrony and resynchrony could be then predictive of the efficiency of this co-regulation relationship. So that's also something that we might be looking at sometime in the future when we have the opportunity.
Interesting, because it really is also, of course, reflected of in the behavior output, right? Like it's about interacting with the person. So it's a, because I'm thinking as I'm talking, but it's really like you're able to look at how the brain is changing during these interactions, emotions, and what have you. And this is like, I mean, it's kind of wild, actually, if you really think about it, because we don't think about this as much as we should. But of course, your brain is changing all the time as we're interacting, right? And I think that this sometimes actually, I mean, as a neuroscientist, okay, yes, I know this exists and I think about it often, but for some people, they don't realize that their brain is actually not hardwired, essentially, we use this term, right? But it's constantly changing as we're doing things, as our environment changes, as we're interacting with others. And essentially, I think, well, with child development and parenting, this is great, but it's necessary, all this plasticity that's happening. But it's fascinating to think about as I'm trying to regulate my child's emotions, my brain is like trying to sort it out. His brain or her brain is trying, you know, is doing some other things, and eventually, hopefully, we're synchronous enough to get the regulation to where we want, or the emotions to where we want.
Yeah.
Complex.
Yes.
Sometimes.
So it's probably, again, if we go back to what we said at the beginning, it's best to think about it as a dance and think about it in a way that everything is connected, right? My behavior is influencing my interaction partner's behavior, and their behavior is influencing my behavior. And the same happens in the brain, because the behavior and the brain activity are intrinsically linked. And, you know, the important thing here is that studying this on a behavioral level itself is already very interesting, and it can lead to extremely important insights. And the same is true for the brain. It's not that, you know, we are doing something special or more interesting. It's just to see that this is also mirrored on the brain. And then if we can combine those two approaches and show that it is not only visible in the behavior, but also visible in the brain, and that those two modalities are actually related to one another, then I think we have several pieces of the puzzle, and we can get to more rich and more overarching conclusions. But we need both of these, and we need the combination of them. And then hopefully we can understand the neural basis or the neurobehavioral basis of attachment and caregiving better.
Yeah. And I also think that people, like when they think about, oh, my brain is changing or my brain health is important, that's actually really meaningful. So in this day and age, I think we're more curious about our brain health. And so when they're like, oh, it's important for my brain to do that, it's important for my child's brain to be like that, it's important for us to, you know, interact in this positive way because it's healthy for us and our brains, that sometimes is a really important message.
Yeah, at the same time, we have to be a little bit careful, because there is lots of messaging out there saying that X changes the brain or Y changes the brain, right? And for example, I did some research on meditation some years ago, and that was one of the main messages that was there in the media almost every week, right? If you do this kind of meditation, it changes your brain. If you do this kind of meditation, it changes your brain. And I think we have to be very careful there, because as you said before, everything changes the brain, right? If we start practicing the piano, our brain will be changed. If we only eat tomatoes for a week, we will have a different brain. If we go to space and come back, our brain will be different. So, you know, the difference in the brain itself is not really what is interesting or what counts, because that's completely natural. It's going to happen all the time. But to understand why the brain changes and what it means for our behavior and for our interactions, I think that's the important point.
And also, I think it gives a lot of people hope to know that they can change and their brain can change. Sometimes I think understanding, because people will be like, yeah, but that's just how I am, or my brain's hardwired because I saw a post that said my attachment early in life screwed up my brain, you know, like there's these things about how people tie up my early life was like this. And so my brain is like this, and then I can't be any different. And I think by saying, oh, look, it's a lot of stuff can change, is changing in your brain too. And this happens all the time. This then gives some hope and relief that people can, you know, essentially modify their behavior and their brain will be modified as well, kind of thing. Right. So there's kind of, yeah, I totally agree that we need to understand how the brain is functioning and related to behavior and life in general. But then there's also this piece of it. It does give a lot of hope to people to know that they aren't wired a certain way and that things can change. Right. But I also completely agree that there's no one way to do parenting or interact with someone. I mean, of course, we know that there are some very socially acceptable ways, but those might not be ways that always work for you, right? I mean, I think fundamentally, parenting itself is really a special kind of relationship that exists and can vary depending on you, your kid, your partner, and a lot of different factors.
Yep. And that's where I think, especially when we consider attachment parenting, that's where I think the risks are a little bit, because what attachment parenting does is it's really prescriptive, right? You have to breastfeed, you have to sleep very close to your baby, you have to do this, you have to do that. And unfortunately, this is then thought to be understood as, if you do this, then your child will develop a secure attachment. And there is little research that supports this. And the importance here is that, yeah, everybody is different. Everybody has a different life history. Every interaction is different. Every parent is different. Every child is different. And it's more about the overall consistency and the overall sensitivity and appropriate responding that determines how the parent-child interaction is going to, or relationship is going to unfold. I wanted to say something about what you said before, and now I forgot. Oh yeah, of course. We all have a backpack, right? So we all have to appreciate that there are early influences and there are significant life events that will influence us strongly and that will leave some kind of mark in our behavior, but also in our brain. And for some experiences, especially if they were traumatic or if they were very strong and negative, of course, it's more difficult to overcome them, both in terms of behavior and in terms of brain restructuring and brain activity. But there always remains room for change. Although this room for change sometimes is a bit smaller, sometimes it's a bit bigger, and some changes are more difficult to happen than others. But definitely, yes, we should not think that our attachment, once it's established early, is going to be predetermining all of our relationships. And this holds true for both our behavior and our brain. We remain plastic, we remain able to change, but for certain things, it will require a bit more effort. And we shouldn't think that it just happens by itself all the time.
Yeah, definitely. Well said. I think it requires effort and creativity often to find out what works best for you.
Yeah,
it's all very interesting. Okay, but final question then would be, what's next for you for your research?
Yes, so fingers crossed that we can do all of these things. But the next thing is, as you mentioned at the beginning, I want to start looking at triads. So I want to invite moms, dads, and their children to the lab. And since at the moment we only have two devices, we decided to invite moms, dads, and their kids, but to only measure brain activity from both parents while they actually interact with the child. So we also want to look at this part of the relationship. How do moms and dads' brains synchronize when they interact with their children?
At the same time. Oh, wow. This is challenging, though. Because I think, how often do parents do this? Sometimes it's like, you take care of this, I'll take care of that. But I think this is super cool.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. We will start piloting soon. And then the second thing that I want to do is to also look a little bit at the synchrony from a clinical perspective. So we are building a relationship with the local NHS, with the National Health Service here, to invite families with neurodiverse children, and also to look at children who have an experience with foster care or adoption, and to see how those synchrony patterns play out there again from a caregiving and an attachment perspective. And finally, what I also would like to do is to make our research and theory a bit more accessible and hopefully helpful for as many people as possible, because, you know, it's nice and interesting to do fundamental research to see how things really work. But then the other thing is also to make use of that knowledge to help people. So we would like to, like with my Q&A, we would like to open it up, make it accessible to people. We also are also collaborating with the charity Baby Grow, who wrote a free book for parents based on my attachment research. And they are now just starting to offer professional training with that knowledge to people working with children and families. And I would like to maybe also see whether this could be used in an educational context, you know, in schools and kindergartens and places like that. So yeah, I'm translate this research a little bit and get in touch with people, with organizations working with that, for example, to spread the word and to hopefully help as many people as possible to have better and more fulfilled relationships.
Oh, yeah, that's lovely. I'm glad you're doing all of this on all these levels, right? Because I think often we get stuck in our science, which is lovely. I love doing my research. But then if you start to think about the translational piece, you start to realize how much we're often missing, or how much the general public isn't learning about what we do. And so what you're doing is really great, really great. And you'll have to give me the link or the information for the book, because I'll post it if it's readily available for download. Is it as well?
Yes. Yeah. So the PDF version is free download, or you can request a paperback version for just £10. So yeah, very happy to give you that information.
Yeah. So, and I'll share it with everyone, some links to, yeah, your social media, as well as to this. And I always put a link up to the paper we talked about, but then I'm really excited to find out more about your research that's ongoing. I think each of the future areas is super interesting and needed, of course, in this area of research, but also even the paper that's under review, I'm going to keep my eyes out for this one.
Yeah. Thank you. Fingers crossed. It always takes a long time and it's quite unpredictable, but eventually it will be published and hopefully read by quite a few people.
Questions, comments, suggestions, get in touch at Mommy Brain Revisited on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. You can also contact me on my website at jodipaluski.com. That's JODIPAWLUSKI.com. Looking forward to hearing from you.
Stripe.